Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm excited today to have a show about global health. I have with me a CA3 resident from Texas A&M Scott and White Memorial Center, Medical Center in Texas, and that is Dr. Matt Danley, and he is going to tell us a lot about some really interesting work he's done and some thoughts he's put into the whole issue of global health and global surgery. I think it's going to be really interesting. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Matt, let's talk about, one of the ways this kind of came about was that you have taken a trip relatively recently to Kenya. I think it was your first global health trip. So tell me a little bit about how that trip came about and what you did while you were there.
Sure. So this was a trip that I took September of last year. It was one of those rare serendipitous events that just more or less fell into my lap. And it was a situation to where you just kind of had to say yes to it, because it was really everything that I feel, or at least I felt at the time and still feel, that global health should be about. I was working, I was doing my pediatric rotation. I was on a Saturday call with one of our pediatric staff who had been to Kenya several times, Dr. Jolene Bean. She worked closely with Dr. Newton, who is the site chief for Vanderbilt at Kajabi Hospital in Kenya. We were out on a beautiful March day, and she was telling me about this amazing opportunity to go to Africa. And the part that really piqued my interest was, it wasn't a go provide a service, you know, come back and, you know, that's it. The point of the mission in Kajabi is education. So I went, followed my CA3 year, and what I did was I was an educator. And I gave 4 lectures in the morning covering topics that I'm interested in, like cardiac mechanics and pulmonary hypertension. And we did case conferences that covered common problems that they see, like pain control for total joints and craniotomies for TBIs and brain tumors and the such, which are fairly common procedures that they do there. And it was a fantastic experience. It was completely different from what I had originally pictured a short-term medical mission trip being: going, providing care, leaving, and getting that, you know, experience of having that international experience, which is valuable. But really, I questioned in those types of missions, you know, what is the long-term lasting effect that I'm causing? And am I really trying to get at some of the problems? Am I really solving any major worldwide global surgery access problems with those types of missions? And, you know, by and large, we don't. You know, short-term missions that are focused on providing a single service and then coming back, I feel, at least in my opinion, miss a big overarching problem in the world, which is we just don't have enough anesthesia providers, particularly in Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. When you think about where we live in the United States, you know, we have well over 20 anesthesia providers per 100,000 population, well over, and certainly in bigger metropolitan areas, that number may be 40 or higher. When you look at somewhere like Kenya, Somalia, Uganda, Tanzania, these are countries that have millions of people, you know, 40-some-odd million people in Kenya, and they have 0.44 anesthesia providers per 100,000 people. There's just not access. And one of the ways that we, as, you know, as educators and as anesthesiologists and anesthesia residents, one way that I feel we can really affect the world is go around and actually train and provide training for these Kenyans and Ugandans and Tanzanians on how to take care of themselves and build their own workforce.
So, Matt, you know, let's delve into this a little bit, because I think this is really interesting. So, are you distinguishing between a trip where you would go and provide care personally, and then that compared to a trip where you're going and educating people there to provide care?
Correct. When you look at most of short-term medical missions, and short-term medical mission is usually anything less than about 4 weeks. 4 to 8 weeks is kind of the top end for what would be considered a short-term medical mission. And those, by and large, a lot of them are faith-based, and I would say prior to maybe 50 years ago, the vast majority were faith-based organizations, such as Christian organizations that are sending missionaries to do this type of work, Catholic organizations, etc. And they do provide access, which can be a benefit, but the real issue in some of these, in most of these areas that we're talking about, is just the lack of infrastructure, the lack of a healthcare delivery network, the lack of a workforce that can provide this service year-round and really build the economy in that country where you're working. So I always had a bit of a reservation about just going and providing a service. I think there is some value there, but for me, the economics, I just couldn't make sense in my head about why it was okay for me to go and provide a service where most of those services are kind of output-based. You know, we want to go and raise X number of dollars, provide X number of surgeries, and really it's kind of a tertiary goal is, or maybe not even goal at all, of actual data collection and following the outcomes and how we're affecting the local economies, which is just not really that well known. We are getting a huge push towards having more data collection in certain rural parts of the world where we're doing these type of events. But for me, it just this type of trip that is much more focused on educating and building the global educational capacity for Kenyans to take care of Kenyans or Ugandans to take care of Ugandans just made so much more sense to me and was a real, real just blessing to be a part of.
Yeah, that sounds like a great opportunity. So I want to tell me a little more, because I think some people out there are going to say, okay, you know, I absolutely get that going and teaching people to provide care for their own people is a great thing to do. But if I want to go and do 2 weeks of, you know, surgeries, that wouldn't have been done if I hadn't gone, mm-hmm. You know, isn't that good for those people who got the surgeries? And so is the, now do you tell me if I'm wrong, but is the idea that yes, of course that's good in the short term, but that if instead of that you were providing education, then, you know, kind of like the teach a man to fish, right? You're going to affect much more and long term over time.
You know, I think if you talk to, it's my opinion. I think if you talk to people that, physicians that are, you know, make a passion, a lifelong career out of this, that most of them would say, you know, it really requires long-term commitments. And for to instill real lasting change, that requires significant investment. If you're a resident, you want to go, or you're a staff and you want to go to, you know, Haiti and provide anesthesia for surgery, and there's no other anesthetic providers there, then of course you're increasing access. But are we really changing the underlying fundamental problem in that country for mm-hmm. a lack of access to care? And I think as long as you approach missions and with that mindset that I'm going to go and provide the service, but I, as a auditor of what I'm doing, want to make sure that if we're doing surgery, there's proper follow-up, and it's not just day one through three follow-up. It's how are you doing 3 months out, or how are you doing 2 weeks out? And sometimes that's really hard because these are very transient patient populations, and it's hard to really gather that data. And if you're an NGO and trying to fundraise to go and provide surgeries, you're probably not going to fundraise a lot to actually perform data collection, at least long-term data collection on these transient patient populations. So it's an inherent difficulty in the short-term medical mission mindset of trying to have long-term data and outcomes data, and really changing the mindset to we need to be an output, you know, generating organizations to we need to focus on outcomes. Which is the whole point of education, that long-term commitment.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So tell me a little more about the trip. What were some of the things that surprised you? This was your first global trip, I think, right? So were there things that you saw or learned about that you hadn't anticipated?
I was immensely surprised and impressed by the culture in Kenya. The great aspect about Kenya is it was an English colony until, you know, into the 20th century. So everybody speaks English as the language of business. They speak Swahili as conversational language, and then they have tribal tongues. But every person I walked by in the operating room or in the theater when I was walking around helping out stopped, asked who I was, asked how long I was there. When I told them, you know, I was going to be here for 2.5 weeks, they say, "Oh, that's not long enough. You should stay longer. We're glad you're here. Thank you for being here. Whenever I would give lectures in the morning, it like eyes glued on me the entire time, which in today's time, you know, with the, you know, 24-second news cycle and you always have to be checking your phone, it was just incredibly eye-opening to see how humble, welcoming, and teachable these Kenyan registered nurse anesthetist students are, and just how hungry for knowledge, because they realize, you know, it's an 18-month program for them to become an anesthesia provider that's licensed to practice independently in the country of Kenya. So they understand that at the end of their training, they're going to go and they're going to face traumas. You know, 90% of the world's trauma deaths are in Africa. You know, roads are more deadly than mosquitoes in Africa. There's a lifetime mortality rate for pregnancy in Africa, about 1 in 40. So there's a lot of obstructive labor cases that are not going to turn out well. So they're very aware of the challenges that they face and a limited resource setting. So anybody that goes there tries to offer them any type of education. It was just mind-blowing how receptive they were. It was pretty amazing.
That's great. Well, let's talk about the resources. So, you know, let's start with the providers themselves. So what you mentioned, these are CRNA students. Mm-hmm. Is that the bulk of the providers, both in Kenya and the developing world, or who's providing anesthesia care? Are there anesthesiologists, CRNAs, are there others?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So there's a varying definition of what an anesthesia provider actually is in different parts of the world, and this might be surprising for some, but there are physician anesthesiologists in Kenya. There's about 46 million people that live in Kenya, and there's about 200 physician anesthesiologists. So a drop in the bucket. Nurse anesthetists are there. These are the Kenyan registered nurse anesthetists. So this is a program that was started by Dr. Newton in Kajabi, and now they have a couple satellite areas of education as well. There's maybe 100, 120 maybe nurse anesthetists, and that number is going to increase fairly substantially due to the work that that he's doing there. And those were some of the students that I had the pleasure to meet and to work with. And then there's this whole host of other anesthesia providers in these rural parts of these countries. And that's actually the bulk of the anesthesia providers in Kenya, at least the World Federation of Societies of Anesthesia, you know, has this data that they've collected. And most of, you know, about 500 of the 800 anesthesia providers in Kenya are actually qualified as, quote, other anesthesia providers. And these can be as simple as a nurse, you know, maybe not even has an RN degree. Someone that is a healthcare, quote, provider that took a 5-day course for emergency anesthesia with ketamine. And if you have someone come in with a traumatic brain injury and, you know, kind of a random, you know, small part of the country, even if they could do neurosurgery, you know, your only anesthesia provider might be someone that only uses ketamine. It could go from that all the way to a medical school graduate that's had 6 months of emergency obstetric anesthesia for rural practice. So the only thing that person is really trained to do is obstetric anesthesia, which in Kenya, as we talked about, is very important. The Kenyan registered nurse anesthetist program is you have a nursing degree, and you do some work in a critical care setting. You apply for a position just like you would. It's kind of would seem very similar to what you would try to do in the United States. And then they actually go through an entire comprehensive training program, which makes them similar to what you would think of as maybe a novice CRNA here. I would say novice, but you would be surprised with how amazing how well they cope, I should say, with the limited resources they have. And of course, all the way up to the four, you know, well, they have MBBSs, or it's kind of a British system there. So about 6 years mm-hmm. of medical school. And then you can, of course, do your postdoc training as well.
So there are some small number, did you say four anesthesiologists?
There's about 200 physician anesthesiologists, somewhere in the maybe mid-hundreds for nurse anesthetist providers, and that will increase with increasing education production there. And maybe about 450 to 500 of these other anesthesia providers that fall anywhere on a wide spectrum of what they're trained to do.
Interesting. All right. So there are people with very little training using kind of what they've got, but doing the job that no one else can do, right?
Yeah. I had this during one of the case conferences I was doing, I had this Somali student that was, she was a senior, so she had done a year in Kajabi in Kenya and then went back to Somalia for her kind of last 6 months of training in one of her community hospitals. And she, we were talking about ICP and traumatic brain injury and you know, how you think through that. And she comes over Skype and she's like, hey, you know, I've got rock aronium, succinylcholine, ketamine. The only volatile agent I have is halothane. I've got Versed and fentanyl, but if I need to do an anesthetic, you know, how do I do this? And you're looking at that and you're trying to think, you know, well, you would never use ketamine. You wouldn't want to. You really don't want to use halothane. So it was a great experience for me because it really puts you outside that comfort zone where now you're having to think about, okay, I'm not in Kansas anymore. You know, we got to figure out how you're going to do this safely. Thankfully, you know, talking with them, they're incredibly bright. And they realize that this is a problem and I need to learn how to do this, which goes back to my point about just how receptive and hungry they are for information.
That's really interesting. So when you're thinking about, and, you know, let's say people out there may think, you know, I'd love to do a trip like this. What advice do you have for people? What do you want to keep in mind when you're getting ready to go, when you're setting up for a trip like this? What is there anything that you think, oh, if I could go back to before I left, I would do it differently?
Mm-hmm. I think I was incredibly fortunate because Kajabi is a international elective rotation site for both Vanderbilt residents, anesthesia residents, and surgery residents. And Temple University in Philadelphia also has an international elective there. So the framework for and the logistical support to get me to from the airport to a grocery store to where I was staying. They have dorms on the site, which, you know, helps with housing. I think that is, I was incredibly fortunate in that aspect because if you don't have that type of infrastructure already set up, then it can certainly, you don't want to be in, especially a conflict ridden area. You would never, you know, do that in, say, in Somalia or Yemen. I don't think most of us would ever want to go to those places, at least not right now. But having that infrastructure already in place was hugely beneficial for me. And that's what I would actually recommend. If this is going to be your first trip, go with a group. Go somewhere that's established and that is fulfilling a need and a mission that you ethically agree with. And that may be, you know, my wife's a speech therapist, and going down and doing Operation Smile in Peru was a huge eye-opener for her. But if you're doing those types of things, which is fantastic, because in, you know, in South America, having cleft lips and palates are really, there's an aesthetic issue that these people are shunned. It's also a speech impediment. And when you go, realize that one of the most important things to do is, you know, even though you're providing the service and you need to be cognizant about what it's doing to the local economy and how to provide appropriate follow-up for those patients, but also understand what the patient wants to get out of it. In many parts of South America, you know, the aesthetics isn't the primary concern. The primary concern is I need to be able to talk. So I want my speech to be more fluent. So if you go on a trip and you're providing, say you're an ENT or you go with ENTs to do these cleft lip and palate repairs or plastic surgeons, realize that if the main goal of the patient that you're providing that care for is to be able to talk and you don't have a speech therapist there that can help provide that therapy postoperatively, then you're providing a service, but the patient isn't benefiting to the point where they want to be, you know, benefiting. And we should be cognizant of that, you know, we're going to provide these services, but we also want to make sure that the patient, just like if you're in Maryland, you know, the service that you're providing, you want the patient to get their goal about undergoing a surgical procedure and having the postoperative pain to deal with. So making sure that we're actually addressing the patient's need is an important aspect whenever you're deciding, you know, where to go and which trips to take.
Right. And you mentioned Operation Smile. There's also Operation Rainbow, Doctors Without Borders. There's a variety of these well-known groups.
Yes.
Do you recommend people look into those if they're looking?
You know, I certainly haven't looked through all of them, and I don't have one in particular. I elected not, since there was such great infrastructure already set up for Kajabi, I elected not to go through any sponsoring entity and
right.
went just with Dr. Bean and kind of did everything by myself with a huge amount of support from the hospital staff there at Kajabi. But Samaritan's Purse was one that was fairly common, at least at that institution. It's a faith-based organization that has placed longer-term missionaries there. I believe there is a family practice doctor there and an ENT surgeon. The family practice doctor, I believe, was from Waco and the ENT from Detroit. And they were both there on two-year-long missions. And I believe they were both sponsored by you know, faith-based organizations like Samaritan's Purse. So you certainly, even if you didn't want to go and do, you know, that long of a trip, you know, sponsoring those institutions by donations or, you know, supply donations or things like that can be beneficial as well, because you're helping support a long-term missionary that is there that's going to provide follow-up for years. And there are ENT residents that rotate at that hospital that are being trained by American surgeons, which is, again, building that global workforce for good.
Right. That sounds great. So you had mentioned to me the Lancet Commission report from mm-hmm. 2015. Mm-hmm. You want to say a few words about that and why that was important?
Yeah, this is once I got back, I just kind of fell in love with this idea of increasing global educational capacity and how can I really get plugged into the teaching aspect of this. And what I came across was this this idea that, you know, over the past 25 years, global health as a whole has had substantial gains. But unfortunately, that progress hasn't really trickled over into surgical access. Surgical care for low and middle income countries hasn't really grown at all. And fatality rates are still very high for even as common conditions as hernias and appendicitis and fractures and obstructed labor. Even breast and cervical cancer have higher mortality rates than what we'd ever imagine in the Western world. And when you look at where we spend most of our, well, where we spend a chunk of global health dollars, there are certainly important areas such as HIV, which kills, you know, 1.5 million people per year. TB, tuberculosis, and malaria both kill about 1.2 million people per year. But when you look at surgical causes of death, you know, surgical causes account for about 17 million people per year. And that's an area in which, you know, it seems expensive. And I think that's the main barrier whenever I talk to people about surgical care. It's like, well, yeah, but you need a hospital. You need anesthesia providers. You need nursing care. And there are definitely needs to provide safe surgical care, including equipment and supplies. Kajabi, a lot of the supplies is reused. You know, the LMAs get washed and sanitized. The circuits get washed and sanitized. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is certainly a need there. You need to have sterilization capacity so that you can, what equipment you have to provide, you know, these, you know, bellwether procedures, as they call it, you know, laparotomies, C-sections, and treatments for open fractures. You have to be able to sterilize them. You have to have a blood supply. You know, there's, how do you do a blood bank in rural, Ethiopia? You know, there's definitely, problems with some aspects of these, but you can have access without all of the needs, but the needs are certainly real. When you're looking at all of the different problems and all the different goals for the Lancet Global Commission, there's really, you know, five big key messages. There's about 5 billion people in the world that don't have access to safe, affordable surgical care. And the big problem is safe and affordable access. We need about 143 million additional surgical procedures per year. And about 33 million individuals will face catastrophic health expenditure due to payment. So you can have access. You can have this, you know, multi-million-dollar blood bank in the middle of, you know, Uganda. But if patients have to spend their entire year's salary to make it to your hospital, then is that really access? And it's not. So you have to have you have to have government buy-in for these to really fulfill these needs to make this a realistic a goal for individuals. But when you look at the actual cost, investment in surgical anesthesia services, it is affordable. And when you look at the difference in, you know, what we spend for malaria nets, for example, we spend maybe between $6 to $20 per disability adjusted life year prevention from malaria using bed nets. You could spend about $13 for a circumcision and also prevent the same amount of disability adjusted life years, because whenever we provide circumcisions, we reduce the risk of STD transmission, penile cancer, and the like. So it's just as cost effective. When we do cleft lip and palate repairs, it costs about $48 compared to a BCG vaccine, which is about $50 to $200, depending on where in the world you are. It's the same way with general surgery, $80 per disability life-adjusted year. Hydrocephalus surgery, $100 per life-adjusted year. Orthopedic surgery. So when you think about a young, healthy man that works on a farm, whenever that individual has a broken arm and now becomes disabled and can't work anymore, that is that's a huge hit to that community. That individual may have been supporting his entire family, may have had 6 people living at home that now he can't support. So by providing these types of procedures, you know, it really is a cost-effective investment.
Yeah, and then even more so, obviously, if you're educating the local community of how to provide these procedures themselves, then, you know, you're really expanding access even more.
Exactly.
And when you got back from your trip, you actually started a global outreach program. Tell me a little bit about that. Was it these kind of thoughts and the findings from that commission report that made you want to kind of continue to be more involved?
It did. I grew up in a house of educators. You know, my mom's a teacher. My dad has coached me and all my brothers through years and years and years of baseball. So I came from a family of educators. And what I really wanted to spark in at least our residents here and in the staff was this idea that you can be a part of something that is as big as increasing global educational capacity on a worldwide scale. You obviously have to start small, and you have to start with just educating people that this is something that is available. So what we decided to do was start the Baylor Scott & White Global Outreach Program, the idea of which being send one or two residents per year at, you know, it's kind of a self-selecting process. They have to be vetted by our program director and such. And I want them to have the ability to have the same type of trip I did, but not have to, I don't want them to have to worry about, you know, can I buy, you know, diapers for my kid this month, or can I go have this amazing life-changing experience educating and, you know, building the global educational workforce, you know, this global anesthesia workforce during residency. So the whole point is to provide matching grants for those residents that want to go. And eventually over the course of several years, I hope that this continues to grow into other departments. And certainly when we talk about the bellwether procedures, laparotomies, C-sections, open fractures are all kind of the major points that you need to have safe surgical care or access to care. So getting general surgeons, orthopedic surgeons, obstetrics, even family medicine, if they feel comfortable doing C-sections and are trained to do those here before they go overseas, would be a branching out point for us in the future. But finding somewhere we can build a long-term relationship to you know, provide that long lasting commitment is definitely what we're trying to do.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And where are you doing the fundraising? How are you coming up with the money to give these matching grants?
That's a great question. I've had significant support from the staff here that have, you know, really decided that they want to make this a priority. There's also some local community leaders here. Temple's, you know, a small town. So if you start something, a lot of times you'll have people that will come on board and really try to make sure it gets done and sees it through. So I've had good support from community members and a lot of the staff here. I feel like there's certainly grants available outside that realm, but I feel like since this is so new that I certainly want, you know, the individuals and the places that we're going to see that this is something that Scott and White as an anesthesia department and as staff and as residents, we all support and want to be part of this, and we see the value and we're investing in that value.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So this is great, Matt. I think, you know, really inspirational work that you've done and are continuing to do, trying to empower and support others in doing the same kind of work. I love the message that really thinking about not just providing services, but providing education is really key. Are there other things you'd like to leave folks with about the work you're doing?
Well, I think if anybody's interested in actually diving through the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery, there are briefs on the website, so you don't have to, you know, kind of dive into the full commission report, but you can find that at lancetglobalsurgery.org. And they have case studies for areas like Zambia and India and Cape Verde on there. There's also an NGO that's also very involved in accessing or working with countries for safe surgical care, which is called safesurgery2020.org. And they have case reports, and they're working in Tanzania, Ethiopia, and Cambodia. And then if all this sounds really good to you and you want to be involved, but you are working, you just can't, you know, you don't have the time to really devote a month or 2 months going and doing something like this, you know, you might have young kids at home. An easy way to be involved in this thing is something as simple as Lifebox. So lifebox.org, they provide pulse oximeters in over 100 countries. And you can imagine, you know, trying to provide an anesthetic without a pulse oximeter is terrifying. And likewise, providing, you know, doing surgery when the lights go out, which happens daily, is also very difficult. So they have a couple different donation levels. $100, you can provide a surgical light for a surgeon that can, it's battery powered, they can keep operating for an expeditious procedure if the electricity goes out, which is a common occurrence. $250 buys a very robust pulse oximeter. So even just doing something as easy as that, it can really make a significant difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember some of the folks where I was a resident at UCSF were very involved with Lifebox, and it's a great organization.
Yes, and I was just going to say I have immense respect for everyone at UCSF. They put on them and Dr. Newton, and they put on a great kind of global health, global surgery symposium type of a thing at ASA this past year. So if you are interested in learning more about this, and after you dive into this, there's always global health lectures and panels at the ASA every year, which at least they have in the past couple of years. So hopefully that keeps going and only continues to grow in the future. So that's another way you can get involved.
Yeah, that's great. And there are actually also global health fellowships. So a good friend of mine from residency, Dr. Mike Lipnick, who is at UCSF, runs a global health fellowship program they have there. It's really interesting. You kind of, I think, spend about half the year abroad doing really robust global health work, and then the other half at UCSF as a faculty member. So you get an appointment on faculty there. You're just not an ACGME fellowship, so you get paid more than you would as an ACGME fellow, and you get to really dive in with some support to global health work and research. So that's really interesting stuff that they've got going on there too, and I'm sure others do as well.
Absolutely. I'm already doing one fellowship in adult cardiothoracic and was planning on a second, but my wife told me that was a no-go. So I'm happy with my one fellowship that I'll be doing next year.
That's right. At some point, the training has to stop.
At some point, it has to stop.
Well, that's fantastic, Matt. Thank you so much. This is really great stuff. And I'm sure people will be looking at these links that we'll put in the show notes, the ones you mentioned, And they may have questions they can post on the website for you that about how to get more involved. So thanks for coming on the show, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. I very much appreciate the opportunity.
All right. That was great. I learned a ton, and I hope you did too. Go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment that we can all see and learn from. Let us know, what global health work have you done? Are there things that you would add to what Matt has had to say? If you have other organizations you've worked with that you like, you can leave us that information as well. Of course, if you are a fan of the show, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It helps others find the show. And if you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. Also, of course, you can go to paypal.me/acrac. That's paypal.me/accrac, and you can make a donation anytime, any place that you'd like. It is much appreciated. Thank you so much to those who are already patrons and have already made donations. We really, really appreciate it. A big shout out, as always, to Brian Park for the outlines he's done for many of the shows. Thank you, Brian. Our original music is produced by Dr. Dennis Kuo. Check out his website at studymusicproject.com. Thank you, Dennis. And that is going to be it for today. Thanks so much for listening. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Matt Danley, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.